Shabbo, reel number 5.
Yes? Well, I think we've finished anything that I can pick up at Dover, except there's just one thing before we leave Dover. I would like to say one very quick word about Joubert. Joubert was Captain Joubert, who was OC 15 Squadron. He was captain when I went there. I believe he was Major Joubert when I went. And he are the perfect CO. And it was Captain Joubert, Major Joubert, who eventually came Air Chief Marshal, Sir Philip Joubert de La Ferté, right until War II and that sort of thing, and subsequently died in Uxbridge Hospital. But one of the very big men of the early flying people.
Exactly why was he such a good CO? Could you develop it a bit?
I'll give a quick instance. Just one quick instance is he had the most fantastic memory for the people. There were some hundreds of people, officers, mechanics, and that sort of thing on Dover Aerodrome. There wasn't one of them who didn't know by name in all his family connections and the trouble with his wife or that sort of thing. And this same extraordinary characteristic, 25 years later, when War II started, and I was wanting to find my way back into flying. I was much too old to go into flying, really, but I did manage it in the long run. But I was actually living in Bordeaux, but I heard that Joubert was going to be in Paris. So I went up from Bordeaux to Paris, and they told me at the hotel, I found out at the hotel that he was staying at, they told me he might be along any minute. And so I went and loafed about outside. The taxi drew up. Joubert got out of it and went straight up to me and said, "Hello, Shabba, what are you doing here?" And that's after 25 years of just being one of the ordinary chaps in his squadron in Dover, 25 years before that. I think that's most unusual.
Now, in July 1915, after this period at Dover, you received your first operational posting.
Yes.
Out to France.
Yes.
Did you go direct to France from Dover?
No, I'll tell you what it was. You remember the purpose of my going to Dover was to get myself to fly a service type of machine. Now then, the flying a service type of monoplane had been broken up, as I've told you. I then qualified on a service type biplane. The first service type biplane which I qualified on was the B-2C. I was then qualified to go overseas, and along came my posting for overseas. That was that. And the actual posting was that I should go to Lim and pick up an aircraft, take it across to Saint-Omer, and then do as I was told. So off I went to Lim, where I ran into five chaps altogether, almost sure it was. Four of us were taking over B-2C, and one was taking over a single-seater Scout of sort. It was either a Bristol, I think it probably was a Bristol or a Sopwith. I'm not sure. There were two little Scouts, were very much the same to look at in those days. There's one very interesting point about the B-2C, which I personally took over, which is this, that I think I have already mentioned that the B-2C, with its stability, with its inherent stability, was a very heavy machine to handle.
Yes.
Now then, Farnborough was obsessed with turning out a machine which would stand up to ill usage. And so, the machine which I actually took over from Lim, not only had the ordinary heavy handling of a B-2C, but it had been fitted with an oleo undercarriage. Now, an oleo undercarriage...
How do you spell that?
O-L-E-O. Yes. O-L-E-O. An oleo undercarriage was, instead of... you know what the undercarriage on an ordinary B-2C like. It's just two Vs of steel tube, streamlined, and an axle and some wheels, and that is that. Well, an oleo undercarriage has oil compression springs, if you like to call them spring oil compression in any case, and it has a little wheel sticking out in front to prevent you going over on your nose, and a lot of compression in your undercarriage, a lot of compression in your undercarriage wheels, all very nice indeed, but weighing at least 10 times as much as the ordinary undercarriage of the ordinary 2C has, and making your aircraft even less war-worthy than it was before. In any case, this Oleo undercarriage, which they fitted to quite a number, and they'd spent a lot of time at Farnborough experimenting on to perfect it for the job, was howled down by everyone in France. Strictly, they had anything to do with it, for that very simple reason, that it did make the B2C already cumbersome, much more cumbersome than it was before. Anyhow,
where did you land?
The one which I took over, it was had an Oleo undercarriage. I can't think why, but it was arranged that we should land at Bordeaux. Not Bordeaux at all, Boulogne. Just leap across the channel and land at Boulogne, which we did. I think it was to pick up some further instructions. I'm not quite sure. In any case, we landed at Boulogne. And there, one thing I do remember, the single-seater scout, Bristol or Sopwith, whichever it was, went over and finished up on its back, and that was the end of that. And so of the five, which had started out from Lim, four, of which I was one, eventually arrived at Saint-Omer.
When you got to Saint-Omer, were you immediately posted to a squadron, or was there any stage?
No, I was hanging about for a few days, because they were sorting out what people were arriving and fitting them in, where they were mostly fitted or where they had demands from and that sort of thing. I don't really know. But I was in Saint-Omer for, as far as I recollect, about two or three days, during which time they put me through a little bit of flying, tests on a BE-2 of sorts, that is, say, the old Walt Wing type, which was out of service. It was no longer a service machine, but they used it to give people a bit of practice on at Saint-Omer. I did a little bit of flying around in this BE in Saint-Omer, sufficient to satisfy them, I suppose, that I could take it off the ground and put it back again, which, as I've said before, constituted as much as one learnt about flying in these days. Having satisfied themselves that I could take it off the ground and put it on the ground again, then came my orders to go ahead to number 4 squadron, and this, after all this chitter-chatter, this number 4 squadron is my first squadron in the actual war.
Now, after Saint-Omer, you were posted to number 4 squadron at Bézieux.
Yes.
How was this squadron organised exactly? Was it on a properly structured and constructed air station, or was it fairly temporary as far as its location and buildings were concerned?
Yes, as far as the work which the squadron had to do, the squadron was a what you might call a general-purpose squadron. As the whole of the RFC had been, as when it first went to France, there weren't individual squadrons doing individual functions. They hadn't got specialised as they got specialised later on. And we were still in the unspecialised state. And the general work which we did in number 4 squadron was ranging artillery, ranging the guns, and that in itself, the method of doing it, was very undeveloped. We did reconnaissance. We did a short reconnaissance and a long reconnaissance. And if anything wanted to fight us in the air, we did not go out deliberately for fighting. If anybody wanted to fight us in the air, we were supposed to fight them back. And so we were just entirely a general-purpose squadron.
Okay, what was Bézieux actually like?
Bézieux was a tiny little... Yeah. Bézieux was almost less than a village. It's something like 20 or round figures, something like 20 miles southwest of Albert. And halfway between Albert and Amiens, yes. And just a little village. And as far as accommodation is concerned, the aircraft were accommodated in what we called RAF hangars, that is to say, canvas hangars of the outline of the aircraft, each accommodating precisely one aircraft. And precisely one aircraft, and not only that, it was such a tight fit. It's such a tight fit that we had to dig little channels for the two wheels to go into, because the entrance to the little hangar was slightly too low for our aircraft to go in without damaging it. And so we dropped the wheels a little bit as we went in. That illustrates to you the size of the hangar we're working in. The canvas pulls right around it, and the work, all the work which is wanted on that aircraft, is done. And here is a very great deal of difference between a squadron then and a squadron today. A flight had to be virtually self-supporting. It did its own maintenance, its aircraft maintenance. It had its own transport. One of the flying officers was usually put in charge of the transport, its own Crossley tender and that sort of thing. And engine jobs and that sort of thing, not up to major overhauls, but things like cylinders off, valves grinding and that sort of thing, were done in the flight by the flight staff.
Could you tell me what arrangements were made for quartering squadron personnel?
As far as the personnel is concerned, we were just dumped on a little village, and we were accommodated in whatever accommodation the village had to give us. I personally had a room in a little cottage. It was a little cottage with only one room to spare, and it was simply accommodation, because my living, my meals and that sort of thing were all in the mess. And I did nothing had nothing to do in this billet except to sleep there. Went home to sleep there at night and came out again in the morning. And the rest of the time was spent either in the mess or on the aerodrome or doing a job of work.
You mentioned that one of the highlights of the squadron activities at Bézieux was the spy-dropping episode.
Oh, was it not? A very important episode, as a matter of fact.
Perhaps you could describe that.
Yes, it grew. Whether it was actually the first spy to... when we say spy dropping, that's quite wrong. The spy was not dropped, the spy was landed. You see, parachutes, we have not come into the era of parachutes by a long time. And so... what actually happened was that the squadron was informed that the army had up their sleeve a Frenchman who was prepared to be put onto the other side of the line somewhere in the St. Quentin neighborhood, which he knew. And the squadron was required to take him over. Now, this job was offered to whoever would like to do it. Whoever would volunteer for the job, because of something like a bit of an unusual job. Now, it just happened there was in our squadron was a chap called Jack Woodhouse. Jack Woodhouse had just been on leave, and he very badly could do with another spot of leave. I think he might have been a little romance on his leave, or what, I can't tell you. And so, when a little bit of extra leave was offered for anybody who would take on this job and do it, Jack Woodhouse was the very first boy to stick up his hand. Right, then there followed, the prospective spy arrived on the scene. He was a rotund Frenchman, and according to rumour, he had been waiting for the guillotine for something or other, and he had been offered this spy job if he'd care to do it and escape the guillotine. I can't tell the truth of that. That was only what local rumour told us. The first thing that happened was Woodhouse started practising with this spy. Now, one of the things that the army insisted was that he must go. This spy chap came over in ordinary French civilian clothes. the army insisted that he must be in uniform. If he was in uniform, that would save he and Woodhouse both getting shot as spies if they should get caught on the other side. And so this chap was put into a French greatcoat. I'm mentioning this because it made it all the more difficult for getting in and out of the aeroplane, and he's got to get out of the aeroplane to get away. Now, also, he had to carry a load of pigeons, because pigeons from the other side was the only means by which he could possibly communicate anything which he wished to communicate with our side, the only possible means there was. And so, incidentally, he was christened Pontius Pilate in the squadron. It's easy if we call him Pontius Pilate because the naval one referred to him. And so Pontius and Woodhouse started a series of trial runs around the airfield, around our own aerodrome at Béziers. Woodhouse would take off, do a quick circuit. On the way round, Pontius would clamber out of the seat, front seat in a two-seat, very close fit, not very easy to do, onto the wing, and Woodhouse would land, and when the machine had slowed down sufficiently, you mustn't forget the most important thing which keeps on cropping up: no brakes at this time, no brakes at all. Brakes didn't come for years and years. When the machine has trundled to a sufficiently so slow speed for Pontius to leap off the plane onto the ground and lay on the ground so as not to be over, not to be knocked over by the tailplane, then they'd practice this again until they'd got reasonably well practiced on it. Right, having got reasonably well practiced, and the evening having been decided, had been decided to do it fair as late as possible, the latest practice.